Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, 25 years in 25 days, 2012.
Everyone wants to say if Elmer's friends out there, if they don't have electricity, it will be on very, very soon. And be careful out there.
Yeah, Elmo in our special coverage on the night that Sandy came ashore, October 29th, 2012. Our then-and-now take on Sandy will look at the recent court settlement over preparedness to help people with disabilities in the next emergency. Also today, Jeff Chang, with his 50-year history of multiculturalism in the arts and real life in the United States. Emily May from Hollaback on that viral video going around. Maybe you've seen it. It's had 15 million views about a woman who gets harassed over and over again on the streets of New York. And why Ad Age reporter Kate Kay let a bunch of companies track all her data. She'll share what she learned about herself and what other people can and cannot easily learn about you. But we begin with a critique from a former FCC commissioner of the gigantic cable and internet merger currently being decided on by regulators in Washington, the merger between cable and internet service giants Comcast and Time Warner. Michael Copps was on the Federal Communications Commission from 2001 to 2011. He's in our studio. Welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Thank you very much, and happy anniversary to you.
Thank you very much. So do you care if Time Warner and Comcast merge? Does this matter for price or for culture or for democracy?
Do I care? Yes, you bet I care. It matters for all of those. My passion during my 11 years at the FCC was to make sure that we had a communications infrastructure that served the needs of the American people. Democratic needs, economic opportunity needs reflect the needs of localism and diversity. And this merger flies in the face of all of that. It's just too much power in one company, and it's in an atmosphere where we need to have diversity and competition and diverse sources of news.
So Comcast argues, for example, and we'll get into internet aspects of it as well as cable TV aspects of it, but one of their arguments is this would not be too big a company for cable TV delivery today because there's just so much competition for people's eyeballs. Netflix, YouTube channels creating original content. We had Harry Shearer, whose series is on YouTube, as a guest yesterday. HBO is now making content available online without a cable subscription. There's so many options other than cable. How much do you buy the argument?
I don't buy that argument at all. Look at the properties that Comcast owns, the NBC, Universal, all of these channels. And look then at the fruits of consolidation generally when these big deals are made. Then they have to finance the deals. In the first place they look is, you know, where can we make the cut? So how about the newsroom, you know? And we end up with investigative journalism hanging by a life thread right now. If it wasn't for you folks in public radio and a few others, we'd be bereft of news and information.
Of course, some of the people who are more sanguine about cable's impact on that say that's fled cable already. CNN isn't really an investigative news organization.
Right.
MSNBC and Fox News Channel are opinion channels. So there wouldn't be anything of great, great value lost if cable were to go away from a news standpoint.
Well, and it's anytime you close a newsroom or combine a newsroom or lay off a reporter, something is lost. And I understand the general point you're making, but we need to, that's not the way we need to be thinking about it. We need to think about how do we enhance our news and information infrastructure to try to make up to for the fact that we've lost 20 or 30,000 newsroom employees in the last few years. I think New York Times just laid off some more.
Yeah,
you know, a week doesn't go by where we don't see a diminution of this. And our country needs really accountability, deep dive, investigative journalism, where a reporter can go off and spend months or even years like it used to be doing a story. Nowadays, the poor reporter's got to file two or three stories a day, take his own camera out of his TV and do that, come back, do a few blogs, and then they look at the ratings in the blogs and see if that story is going to fly, and otherwise put them on another beat.
Listeners, do you care about the proposed Comcast Time Warner cable and internet service delivery merger? 212-433 WNYC, or if there's anything you always wanted to ask an FCC commissioner but never had one over to dinner, now's your opportunity with Michael Copps, who was on the FCC. And we'll talk a little bit about how the FCC works. This is one of those things that people like me who work in broadcasting know a lot about because it affects our industry, but the average American doesn't know that much about, even though it affects you in our democracy, in our culture, et cetera. So we'll talk a little bit about what the FCC is as we go along here. But 212-433-WNYC, if you want to call in, 212-433-9692. Before we get into the internet aspects, just one more thing about TV content migrating to the web, the phenomenon of cord cutting, as it's coming to be called, disconnecting from cable, is becoming pronounced enough that last year, for the first time ever, at least according to what I read, there was a net drop in the number of U.S. cable households. I guess that's never happened before since cable started coming in the 70s. Do you think that's a true stat? And if so, since you're concerned about the delivery of news and culture, do you think that it is good, bad, or indifferent if everything migrates away from cable eventually to the web?
It depends upon the atmosphere in which the migration takes place, I think. A lot of people are cutting the cord, and the first reaction to that is that's going to enhance consumer choice. But it plays out against a backdrop where you have all of this industry consolidation and these big money fights between distributors and content producers and all that. So what's going to determine whether that really works to the enhancement of consumer welfare is policy. You know, we used to think, oh, we've got this vibrant new technology with broadband and all that, and it's exempt from the normal workings of the marketplace and all. And it took us several years to figure out and realize that wasn't really true. That's why I think you see so many people now coming around and saying, well, this merger and coupled with the open internet proceeding is really – it's coming to my communications platform. Radio and TV and cable programming may be passé and on the way out, but they've also got a lot of influence right here. And I want to develop one thought that you made about getting to know the FCC better. I ask the question, why doesn't the commission, the full commission, the chairman, the five members, go out on the road and talk to the American people about this merger and talk about the open internet? These are the folks that have to live with the consequences of the decision the FCC is going to make, and they're in an inside the Beltway cocoon. You know, they do a few round tables and round robins with the usual suspects, and that's all well and good, but I've probably been to 80 or 90 town hall meetings since I joined the FCC, and I never go to a meeting out in the hinterland where I don't learn something valuable.
Yeah, so maybe we should do that part of the conversation now. FCC, Federal Communications Commission. What's the scope of their power under the law, and how do they most affect ordinary Americans' lives?
Well, it's supposed to be a consumer protection agency. It's supposed to provide and do whatever it can to create an environment where the American people are able to access the latest in communications, telecommunications, media, to provide comparability of service between urban and rural areas, to make sure we don't have a gap, and it has jurisdiction over airwaves and wires both. You know, it has responsibility to provide an infrastructure that's conducive not just to consumer welfare but to the enhancement of our democracy.
How many commissioners on the FCC?
There are five commissioners, and the majority, three, are of the same party as the President of the United States at that particular time.
You were a Bush appointee in 2001, yes?
I was a Bush appointee. The way the practical politics of this works is if there's a Republican president, since the Senate has to confirm each nominee, the president consults with the other party in Congress. So in my case, he would consult with the Democratic people in the Congress, the leaders, and Senator Holling, Senator Daschle at that time. Other people were supportive of my being nominated. So Bush said, okay. He probably came to regret it eventually.
Because the positions that you're taking would be more consistent with Democratic Party positions than with Republican Party positions generally.
Yes, if you define Democratic Party as progressive and not the kind of corporate elite party that we see too much of.
Do you think that Obama has been a disappointment in this respect? Does he not feel strongly enough about consumer issues related to things like Comcast, Time Warner, and net neutrality?
I think they could have been much more progressive on this. You have to realize the impact that a company like Comcast has when its chairman and CEO is on the President's Council on Competitiveness with the whole fundraisers forum and all that. That said, the President is saying some good things about the need for an open Internet right now, but he needs to be much more specific and make sure that his chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, who comes from the cable industry, knows how the President feels about it. Otherwise, the FCC is going to get the President in a lot of trouble.
And given what you said about the Senate having to approve FCC commissioner appointees, I guess that's another reason that control of the Senate being at stake in this election matters to the country.
Well, do you know how nominations are fair in the Senate right now? And you can get nominated for a post like FCC commissioner and sit around for a year or so, yeah, and they don't even have a hearing on you.
As it is, Obama can't get half his judicial nominations through.
You don't recruit good people to government in that kind of an atmosphere.
My guest is Michael Copps, former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission, or on the Federal Communications Commission from 2001 to 2011. And Commissioner, if you think people don't care about this issue, our lines exploded as soon as we put out the phone
Wonderful.
Number.
Wonderful. That's great.
We have 10 full lines. Let's get to some of our callers for you. And Desmond in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Desmond.
Thank you, Ryan, for taking my call. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Okay, I've got three quick things I would like to bring up. The NBC Universal merger should have been stopped. Comcast already has a perilous tie on the industry. A professor from Harvard who wrote the book about the communications industry fully explicated that. She brought that out. The lack of communications during Katrina can be tied to the previous decades of the FCC rulings, and there was virtually no AM or FM stations who were able to remain on the air during Katrina. So you're losing the ability for people to support themselves in time of emergency. And three, the fact that communications is so heavily tied into defense by being able to do the things that they did in San Francisco, where they basically diverted a major feed and looked at the Internet action and was able to look at everyone's communications without a court order. All these things are tied into the business and the government. The government has been bought and sold, and the FCC is another example of where government does not have enough teeth. And the present government right now is making sure that it's, as they say, enough government so you can drown it in a bathtub.
Desmond, thank you very much. Any of that you want to comment on?
Yeah, you make some really good points. I was the only commissioner who voted against that Comcast-NBCU merger a few years back. I did think at the time when it was approved, well, they won't be back for a long time because they spent so darn much money on this merger. And then a couple of years later, they were back and said, oh, we got $45 billion more now, so we're going to buy Time Warner Cable. You're also onto something when you talk about the telecommunications, national security complex. Couple that with the role of big money and the special interests in Washington, D.C., and you can see how uphill some of these battles are to stop these mergers and to guarantee an open Internet. But I've been at this for many years, and I wouldn't be at it still if I didn't have some hope that in the final analysis the grassroots can overcome it. And we were in Brooklyn this week on Monday and had a hearing, and a very diverse and a very enthusiastic audience came out, and they didn't like this merger, and they don't like anything short of real Title II net neutrality regulations.
By the way, I should mention that in addition to being a former commissioner on the FCC, Michael Copps is a special advisor to the Common Cause Media and Democracy Reform Initiative, the good government group Common Cause, and I guess it's in that context that you're out speaking officially these days, correct?
That's correct, right.
Okay, so just to give Common Cause its due.
But also in the context of just being a concerned citizen.
Julia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Julia.
Good morning, and thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to say that I am opposed to the merger, largely because, A, I'm opposed to any more consolidation in the industry, because I think consolidation discourages it doesn't provide incentives for better service. This is particularly important in this case because, and it's anecdotal evidence, but I haven't heard anything good. In fact, I've heard terrible things about Comcast service from everybody I know who is a Comcast customer, and I'm really not looking forward to them imposing that standard on my cable service.
Because your Time Warner is pretty acceptable in terms of service?
Time Warner is, it's not great, but they've been more responsive lately. I think the telephone company coming into their neighborhood has probably played a role there.
Verizon.
But they're better, yes, but they're better than what I've heard about Comcast.
Thank you, Juliet. Yeah, so Verizon Fios is providing competition for cable, certainly in New York. I guess that's going on around the country. Do you have an impression of Comcast versus Time Warner? And Comcast would be the parent company, so I guess their standards would begin to apply. Because this is not the first time I've heard it said that Comcast is just worse. There are more consumer horror stories than there are with Time Warner Cable.
But it's more than anecdotal evidence. There have been surveys taken that show that these two companies, Comcast and Time Warner Cable, are at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to their credibility in terms of consumers' service. So the proponents of this merger are saying, let's take the worst one and the second worst one and put them together and see what we got. But I like the general take of the caller there. We could put her on the road. The need now is to share those opinions that you so forcefully expressed with your friends and colleagues and give some succor to this grassroots movement, which is the only thing that's going to stop this merger and the only thing that's going to get us to an open Internet.
Though any call-in is a thoroughly unscientific poll, we don't have anybody calling in to support the Time Warner Comcast merger. I don't imagine there's a lot of grassroots can rattling around the country that endorse the Time Warner Comcast merger, and there are pockets of opposition, but they may not have much power at the FCC.
But I always wait for a call to come in with somebody from one of these companies. But that's all right. Let them
call
in.
From who works for the company, right. Who would have the vested interest.
Right.
Here in New York City, one of the things that's going on, maybe you've heard about it, is there's a movement being led by public advocate Letitia James and other politicians to allow the Comcast-Time Warner merger only if it includes free high-speed Internet access for low-income households. Do you think advocates like James have the clout to pressure Comcast or regulators into that kind of a deal at least?
Well, I've got to tell you that I don't think there is any condition that makes this merger acceptable, and that's the same attitude I ended up having with the Comcast-NBCU merger. I've been through so many mergers at the FCC with AT&T and Verizon, all these other companies, and you know, there's always a condition put in about it's in the Comcast NBC, we're going to get broadband out to low-income citizens. But you don't see the really aggressive marketing of that. You don't see them really pushing that, and the numbers of people that take advantage of it compared to who are qualified for it is really tiny. And then you have an FCC that'll put together a big team to analyze a merger, but once the merger's approved, the team breaks up so nobody follows these conditions and makes sure that they're implemented.
That's so interesting, because my understanding is that here in New York there is already a $10 a month, that's low, $10 a month Internet service to poor households as part of a deal around Comcast purchase of NBC Universal a few years ago. So I guess that would pertain to Comcast households. I don't know if it does to Time Warner. So from $10 to zero wouldn't be a groundbreaking change to go that bit down. But you're saying they're not getting out there and marketing it, so there are probably a lot of households that are not connected to broadband, low-income households, because they don't know they can get it for $10 a month.
We've got 31 million households, I read the other day, in the United States of America, 31 million who have no broadband connection, fixed or mobile. You have to realize, at least I believe this is true, that these companies are in the business of marketing scarcity. It's not building infrastructure on their own. We don't have a government policy that really makes this a national mission to build the most important infrastructure of the 21st century. You can't be a productive citizen, find a job or anything else without the availability of high-speed Internet. This is really important to our success. When I went to the FCC, we were probably number one or two. We invented all this stuff with the Internet, and now you can look at the rankings. We're 15th in this, 20th in that, 30th in that. I saw one we were 55 and something. Huh. That's just, you can quibble about which study is the most accurate, but that's not where the United States of America belongs.
I think you raise such an important issue here, the construction of a universal broadband access national infrastructure. But a lot of people would argue that it is precisely the private sector that's going to do that if they have enough profit motive, et cetera, rather than have the government try to build a universal broadband infrastructure. How much do you think it's a hybrid or what?
Their profits look pretty good to me, but we don't have that that national universal service infrastructure. And during the Bush years, I think the atmosphere was business will get this done without any help from government. The free market will get broadband out, even where there's no business case for a company to go. Why would we ever believe something like that?
Mm-hmm. John in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask your guest here, since he was a former SAT director, you know, kind of ask him where he stands on the whole net neutrality issue. You know, as a consumer protection agency, in my view, it seems kind of contradictory that they're looking to instill some higher, more expensive channels where bigger companies will be able to pay for faster connections than, let's say, the other startup companies. And it's almost like a fight for democracy on the internet space. And as a consumer protection agency, I would think that they would be 100% against something like this. But it's such a big conversation and almost something that could pass through. I wanted to get a little perspective on.
Yeah, John, I'm glad you called with us, and we're going to go because your line is breaking up. Commissioner, I don't know if you saw the very funny and very poignant John Oliver show about net neutrality, where he says, you know, this is such an important national issue, but the wrong side is winning because they succeed in making it boring. And if you can send spokespeople out there who are both evil and boring, then you're going to win every time. So for people who still don't know the basics of this issue, tell me if this is a decent one-sentence summary of it. Net neutrality is the idea that companies with money shouldn't be able to buy faster speeds to your computer than non-corporations without so much money can buy, and they get regulated right to slower speeds.
I think that's excellent. This is all about making sure that the most transformative technology of our time, the broadband internet, doesn't become the playground of the few and the wealthy, where the 1% have fast lanes, so-called paid prioritization, and the 99% of us are stuck in the slow lanes. That can't be the future of America because, as I said, you can't be a productive citizen without access to this stuff. I am for the strongest possible net neutrality rules. That means Title II, which means the FCC needs to call Advanced Telecommunications, and assert its jurisdiction. The companies, as you infer, or as you said, are trying to muddle the debate, make it about what it's not. What it's about is the FCC reasserting its authority that it let fritter away over the last 10 years over advanced telecommunications and broadband and make this stuff work for the benefit of the American people.
So if people, as we run out of time here, want to register their own opinions with the FCC, and I think the Justice Department also has something to say about the Comcast-Time Warner merger, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, indeed.
How can they do that, and also on net neutrality?
Well, you get FCC.gov, you know, 3.7 million people, I think, did that. You can go to the Common
Call. Official comment period.
Official comment period.
Is that closed now on net neutrality?
Well, it's closed, but if the numbers come in and all, they know that's happening. You can get to it through Common Cause's website, and we'll register it. We're going around having these hearings in the country. We're going to try to submit that to the record of this proceeding, too. It is really important. You know, your viewers or your listeners listening to the show, probably if you ask them what's the most important issue in the country, you'd get lots of different answers. Not one of those issues will be solved unless we have a communications infrastructure that addresses those issues, digs for the truth, and informs the American people. So if your number one issue is something else, make this year almost number one issue or your second most important issue and get out and advocate and join the grassroots movement to get this done.
Michael Copps, former FCC commissioner, now special advisor to the Common Cause Media and Democracy Reform Initiative. Thank you very much for coming in and having this important conversation with us.
Thank you very much for covering this important issue.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. 25 years in 25 days. It's 2012. Stay with us.